to read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a bestseller novel and inspire you to finish your book. I'm Mark Stay.
And I am Mark DeVoe. And before we dive into this incredibly exciting episode, where we will be finding out about someone who's just debuted on number 3 in the New York Times bestseller chart, we would like to thank all of our patrons, because this show is brought to you, every single one of you that signed up to support this podcast. And if you haven't yet, we would like to ask you to stop what you're doing, put down that quill pen that you'll be holding right now, writing your novel, and get over to bestsellerexperiment.com/support, where you can sign up 3 tiers, $2 a month, $5 a month, or $10 a month. And at the $10 a month level, you get to join the BXP team, which is an incredibly exclusive group of like-minded bestseller experiment nuts who love what this podcast is trying to do, which is inspire you to write and finish that book. So you get access to that. You get access to us in that group. Plus, just a bounty full of other things that you can join us. For example, on a live show once a month as a live audience, you get to ask questions for our interviewees that we're talking to, such as the one we have today. So get over to bestsellerexperiment.com/support and love this podcast with your Wongo, which we'll be forever grateful for. Especially, Mark, the people who've done it this week.
Yeah, a whole bunch of people. Andy Cumbo Floyd, Sean Locke. Now, Sean Locke was already on there, but he's upgraded to become a chart topper. So thank you so much for that, Sean. Really appreciate it. Andy Brown, thank you so much, Andy Brown. Eric Betton. Eric sent us this lovely message on Patreon. He said, "Hello, Marks and fellow writers. As promised some months ago, I've subscribed the very day my first royalty check for my debut thriller, Quarantine, came in." Yay! Congrats, Ray. Eric. He said, "Having sold almost 3,000 books in the relatively small Dutch market." Yay! Double yay, Eric. Fantastic. He says, "So I'm over the moon." So are we, Eric. This is fantastic. He says, "No better way to celebrate than to give you your long overdue return on investment. Listening to you and your guests has made quite a difference while writing my soon-to-be-published next thriller." This is in Dutch. De Prijs, which I've got that completely wrong. Which translates as the prize. Can't wait to dive deep and catch up with you on that mysterious Facebook group as soon as I found the moral strength to rejoin Facebook, that is." So, Eric, thank you so much.
Brilliant.
That warms the cockles of my heart. Just, that you've been so successful. That's an amazing, you know, sales there. And that, you know, it's... It just makes me very happy, Mr. D.
It does. I mean, I was going to say, we need to get Eric to give us some tips on how he sold 3,000. But here's another fun thing. If you're if you write in a non-English speaking language, I would like to tell you, we found out the other day, didn't we? We got a list of all the different countries around the world that people are listening to us. And it's quite incredible. How many was it? It was nearly 100 different countries,
Dave,
wasn't it?
Dave did a bit of digging, didn't he? And it was, we are truly global.
It was
global,
amazing. But
truly global.
So I've got a challenge for anyone listening to this show that is writing a novel with a foreign title. Sign up to Patreon. Tell us the name of your book so we can give it a... Because I want to hear Mark try and pronounce novel titles in Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
More Dutch. Dutch is great. We love a bit of Dutch. A bit of Finnish, maybe. So, but we'd like to say hello to everyone. We didn't quite realise, to be totally honest, we didn't quite realise just how large this podcast... I mean, we've had over 350,000 listeners now. This podcast goes out worldwide. So hello to everyone in all the many countries of the world. And I do hope that you can tell us more about your books, because it just shows you, doesn't it? 3,000 books in what Eric said is a relatively small Dutch market. I mean... Yeah. It's possible. It's absolutely possible. And Eric, thank you for flying the flag for everyone out there.
Well, you know what that is, because Eric has listened to the show. He's got top tips from some of the best authors in the world, top editors from top publishers. He's a fantastic writer himself. You combine all those things. What have you got?
What'd you get?
The
perfect formula.
Oh, Eric, I'm so sorry. the prize and quarantine. Okay. There you go. I can pronounce that.
Excellent. Excellent. And best of luck with your new novel as well. So sorry, Mark, go on. You wanted to say something.
Also, did I mention Andy Brown is a Patreon supporter? Thank you, Andy. And shout out to Rick West. Rick runs the Whitstable Writers Group. So, you know, talking about worldwide, he's 7 minutes up the road. But he invited me to talk to his writers group the other night, which was wonderful. Really great crowd of people. I think we might have some new listeners off the back of that. So welcome any new listeners. But Rick got his phone out there and then and signed up to Patreon while I was in the room. That was amazing. Just watching him tap, tap, tap. I said, make sure you download the app because you can download the episodes on the app because he does a lot of gardening. Rick, so have you gardening today? I hope it's not too hot out there. Drink water, take plenty of rests, and you can download to it and listen to it while you're gardening, ironing, whatever, going for long walks, that sort of thing. So yeah,
that's brilliant.
And the other thing is, for Rick I also signed my first copy of Back to Reality. He bought a copy.
What?
And I signed it there and then. Yeah, paperback.
Mr. Stay living the dream.
Hey.
But I've got to say that is living the dream though, isn't it? I know everyone listening, and I know to sign the first copy of a new book. I mean, to sign any, I'm sure you've signed copies of Robot Overlords before, haven't you, Mark, at the many cons that you've been to. But to sign your first copy of a new book must just feel, how does that feel? Tell me how it feels.
Oh, mate, it's the best. It is the best.
It's
such a wonderful feeling. And if you get a queue, and I count three people as a queue.
Yeah.
You know, it's an amazing feeling. The other thing I do, I try and have a little phrase that I write as well. So for robots, it was death to robots with a couple of exclamation marks, because that's what one of the characters says. With the end of Magic, I will do a variation of when magic is gone, which side will you choose? So I hadn't thought of one for Back to Reality yet. So while I was there, I thought, oh, what do I get back to it? I put, get back! Like the Beatles, you know? So,
get back!
So
nice.
Get back! So do it, get back! I also said thank you for being a lovely host. So, you know.
Oh, so, yeah. Fantastic. Well, I haven't done mine yet.
No, well, that's it. That's the thing. Who is going to be the first person to get a copy signed by both of us?
Hey, maybe we should give one away as a prize.
How are we going? We could do that, couldn't we? Yeah.
Someone's visiting me, so I could sign a copy and it could come back. It could come back to England tomorrow.
Right, okay.
And then you could sign it. Yeah, all right, done.
Bingo.
Let's do
Bingo.
That.
That is a prize. Right. That is a rarity. It's a genuine rarity.
That'll probably be the only book in the world that will be signed by both of us.
Yeah.
Won't it, really, when you think about it? How much would that be on eBay? Got to be at least like $7 or maybe
$8.99.
Yeah, something like that.
I'm not buying it.
At least now, some
sod's written in it. I'm not.
Yeah, exactly. When it becomes a best-selling summer blockbuster smash, though, of course, it might go up to like even $13 or $14. So you just...
Who knows?
Who knows? But I must say something really quickly. If you've ever bought Q magazine, they do this thing. I think they do this in lots of magazines where they ask people to send in pictures of obscure places where they're reading Q magazine. So it'll be write someone up top of like the Himalayas or someone on a beach in Bali or in a, you know, an oxygen tank or something bizarre. I would like to challenge all of our listeners that have not signed up to Patreon, inspired by our good friend Rick West, who signed up at a book club or a book meeting, is think about the weirdest place you could sign up to support us and send us a photo of you doing it.
That's a great idea.
Okay, so we want photos on our Facebook group of just you signing up to Patreon to support us, but doing it in a really bizarre place, or even have your book that you're writing or a book that you want to promote in the background of the photo of you signing up, and then we'll put that on our Facebook page to thousands of people. So there you go. It's just worth it alone just to do that, isn't it, Mr. Stay? These savvy author marketing folks. Brilliant stuff. So Mark, I hear we've just had a lovely Easter. Happy Easter to you, sir.
Yes.
And but you spent your Easter not hunting for Easter eggs. You spent in the four walls of a rather large building, from what I heard. How'd it go?
I was in the Radisson Hotel near Heathrow. Oh, the romance. I was at EasterCon, which is the longest running UK science fiction convention. It's been going for just over 70 years now. And it's hosted the greatest names in science fiction and fantasy, and me. it's great. I don't go there every year. I go every few years, but I do love to go there because it's a great place to catch up with old friends, make lots of new ones. I did a reading from The End of Magic, which was really cool. That went down really well. I did a panel on podcasting and made some new podcasting friends. So hello to all my new podcasting friends and any listeners we picked up from that. You're all very, very welcome. Welcome to the show. That was terrific because that was... Funnily enough, one of the big topics was, how the hell do we make money out of podcasts? It's a dilemma.
And then the room went silent. It's the most interactively dynamic podcast a lot panel of ever.
Actually,
shrug. Come and shrug with us at this conference.
And it was great. And one of our former guests, Gareth L. Powell, and I'll put a link in the show notes to his episode. Gareth. He won his second British Science Fiction Award for Best Novel. So big congratulations to Gareth for that. That was just fantastic. Terrific. And I had a really good time. It's a wonderful conference. I saw loads of great stuff. I saw really good presentation by the author Emma Newman, who's also an audiobook narrator, talking about her process for recording audiobooks. And I'm going to try and reach out to Emma and get on the show because it was fantastic. And it inspired me because I'm sitting there thinking, I have the skill set to do this. And I've got a microphone, fairly decent microphone, and I might give this a go. So
you totally do, because I even suggested that you audiobook the audio from ours. But I think you're right in that it's good to get somebody else to do it because then you get a different take on it. And obviously we're looking for a female. Yeah. And you do a very good female impersonation, Mark, but it's,
I really don't. It's one of those things that you never know what to expect, but you always get really, really fired up. And saw a great set from Mitch Benn, you know, the musician and comedian.
I love Mitch Benn. I've actually got a CD of Mitch Benn, bizarrely enough. Brilliant. I saw Mitch Benn in a tiny little... back of a room pub in Cambridge years ago. There were about six of us doing stand-up. And then he went on to go on to... Because he's very big on the BBC, isn't he?
Yeah, Radio 4 and stuff like that, yeah.
4,
yeah,
that's right. Yeah, he's very funny.
No, he was true. He did a fantastic set, absolutely brilliant set.
He does a brilliant skit about Scotland will be laughing. It's all about global warming, about how Scotland are going to be like getting... It's very funny. If you can find it on YouTube, it's brilliant. But so what did he do at the conference?
He did a gig. He did like an hour and a half set, and it was just on the Saturday night, and it was just the funniest thing ever. He was really good. And because he's at Gollancz, we did a couple of books by him, a couple of novels, which That's are right. really good fun YA science fiction adventures. They're really beautiful books, beautifully, really passionate books. And he's also a fan of Robot Overlords, which is lovely. So he's always very supportive of that. So it was great. And I know I got one of my biggest pledges on The End of Magic because of a tweet. He retweeted me a couple of times. And I know because that big pledger told me she was a big Mitch Benn fan. So thanks, Mitch. Thank you so much.
But it's brilliant. That is so, so kind of him. But it does show the power of people spreading the word. And I think it's often not the people we know directly, but it's the people they know that then come and support. It's that one step removed that makes such a big difference, doesn't it? Yeah. Especially when you're looking to try and get pledges in and you've saturated that initial kind of zone of group of people that you have. So that's fantastic. Yeah. So, and you did a reading and you're starting to get around a bit, aren't you, on these conference circuits, Mr. Stay?
Yeah, well, I've got a few lined up. I'm going to Worldcon in Dublin this August, which is the oldest and the biggest science fiction fantasy convention. There's some very big names going to that. So I'm really looking forward to that. Closer to home, I'm doing Herne Bay Sci-Fi by the Sea, which is on Father's Day in June. And that's such a fun day. It's I did it last year with a couple of author friends, Tom Burgess and Kit Cox, and we just had a laugh all day, sold lots of books, met lots of new readers. The thing with that, I mean, EasterCon is much more literary focused. There's stuff about movies and TV there, but it's much more about the books. And it tends to be people from publishing, people who are writers and hardcore fans. Something like Herne Bay Sci-Fi by the Sea is a big family event. And this is how Comic-Cons have evolved. Because even 10 years ago, it was mostly blokes with t-shirts or you know, dressing up or whatever. But now it's whole families. You'll have grandparents with Star Trek and Star Wars t-shirts on with their kids and their grandkids all coming together, having a really great day. And at the Herne Bay thing, you've got, you know, they'll have props, they'll have cars from the movies, they'll have the Ecto car from Ghostbusters. I know they they always have a giant inflatable Stay Puft Man. And they've got some really serious stars now. They've got stars from Doctor Who and stuff like that coming along. So, and me, I'll be there. So, it looks like it's going to be a really fun day.
It's funny you mention, it feels a bit more like a festival almost than a conference.
It is. It kind of is. Yeah, yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned the Stay Puft Man, because actually, do you know what, Mark? That was the reason we're doing this podcast. The big inflatable Stay Puft Man. Yeah, don't know this, do you? when we had talked, you posted something once on Facebook about, it was when the new Ghostbusters movie was being promoted, and it was in Victoria Station in London or Waterloo. Do you remember that?
It was bursting out of the ground, wasn't it?
Immersing out of the ground, and it was amazing. Yeah. And it just caught my eye. And then you said something about Ghostbusters and the movie and all blah, blah, blah. And that was the post that made me think, I must drop Mark an email. I must drop Mark a note. If you go back and look, it was the day that you posted it, and that's what then led us to talk about, should we do something? Like, should we maybe try? So it's the Stay, if you hadn't posted that. But that's what I love about this world and this life we live in. Sometimes it's the kind of almost smallest things that you don't realize that actually can trigger something like this podcast happening, and you know, all these book deals that have happened through the podcast. And so we really want to kind of get out there to people is, don't underestimate the power of the smallest thing that can happen in your life that can completely change the direction of your life. It's all good stuff.
It's the butterfly effect, isn't it? Isn't it?
It's fantastic. Yeah, chaos theory. It is. Chaos theory actually describes his podcast very neatly.
That's what we should have called it.
We've used it from day one, and it's working perfectly well. So, but talking of incredible writers, we have an absolute treat. Now, this is an interesting story because I remember you telling me about this book that had just blown up. And I'm going to talk about this a bit after the interview, but the minute you mentioned it to me, I then started to see it everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's something that goes on in the minds of everyone when somebody starts talking about your book. And there's an effect that happens, not a chaos theory effect, but I'm going to talk a bit about after the post, after the actual interview. So hang in for that. But Mark, tell us about this incredible interview that you've done this week.
It was a real privilege to talk to Taylor Jenkins Reid. She's an author of a number of novels, including The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, One True Love's Maybe in Another Life. Her books have been, they just books that turn up in Book of the Month groups, or like they get featured in magazines everywhere. But her new book, Daisy Jones and the Six, is, I think, a real breakthrough. It's as you'll see on the cover, it's been picked up by Reese Witherspoon for a TV show. She's executive producing that. And it's just one of these books, everyone who reads it falls in love with it completely. And it's a story about music and rock and roll, Mr. D. How about that?
I know.
It'll never work, will it?
It'll never work. Those just doesn't sell.
And that's again, we'll talk about this afterwards, but one of the problems I think with books about rock and roll is the truth is always much stranger than fiction. But the really clever thing that Taylor has done here, rather than write a straightforward narrative, she's written it as in a kind of non-fiction format, where it's like a very long Rolling Stone interview, oral history, essentially. So you have the names, so it'll say Billy, and then there'll be what Billy says. And it will jump. I mean, if you go on Amazon and just look at a sample page, you'll see exactly what we mean. And it's a genius way of doing it, because you start believing this band is real, which is one of the problems you always have to overcome with this kind of fiction. But yeah, we talk about that more in the interview. But I was delighted to speak to Taylor. She was touring the UK at the time, going from pillar to post. And, this is it's an incredible story how this all came about.
Brilliant. So let's listen to Mark interviewing Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Taylor Jenkins Reid, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
You're on tour in the UK. You've been all over the place, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I was in Dublin and Bath, and now I'm in London, and I'll be in Brighton tonight. Yeah.
Do you even know what time of day it is?
I don't know what time of day. I don't know where I am. I just go where people tell me to go.
Congratulations on Daisy Jones and the Six. It's an extraordinary novel. And the thing that jumped out at me immediately was the format of the book. This wasn't your regular novel. It, you know, on the face of it, it's like a classic kind of Rolling Stone interview format with, you know, the name tags and dialogue, and that's it. And in doing that, you're kind of robbing yourself of a lot of the usual things that authors use. What was the big challenge with that?
I've said it is sort of like writing a book with one hand tied behind your back, because you don't have any direct relationship with the reader. And so, you know, there's no narrator. All the entire story is told through this chorus of voices. You know, and it's typically a nonfiction format. So, you know, I think people are used to reading oral histories when they're reading about real bands or, you know, a real television show or a real cultural moment. But to use it for fiction, it presented a lot of challenges, and then it presented a lot of opportunities. And in terms of challenge, it was very difficult to figure out how I get very specific details into the reader's mind so that they can picture what's going on, while always making sure that those details were given to you by a specific character for a specific reason in a way that felt believable. Mm.
You say it's a format used by real bands, talking about real bands, but that, I think, works to your advantage, because you're reading this, you're thinking, I can't believe this isn't a real band.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why I wanted to do it this way. This is the second book that I've written about a famous person. And, you know, my book before this is called The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, and Evelyn Hugo's a movie star who's going on the record about her life. And so it sort of reads like a fake memoir. And it's important, I think, when you're trying to write about a fake cultural moment, that in order for it to not seem cheesy, you really have to put the idea in the reader's head that this could be real. And writing the book as an oral history did a lot of the heavy lifting for me, because I'm presenting it to the reader as if it is real. The conceit is very, straight-faced, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think it does a lot of the work of inhabiting the reader's mind and saying, oh, like, you know, let me enter this world in which this band was a real band.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've spoken about unreliable narrators on the podcast before. Here, you've got an entire band of them. Well, I love you. You have one line where they say, oh, and they went away for someone's birthday, and then you discover it was actually the wedding anniversary. And just no one remembers how the name of the band came about. All of these things ring completely true. How do you keep track of who's telling the truth, though?
You know, it's interesting. I don't actually keep track of who's telling the truth. I think that's what's so interesting about something like this. When I came up with the idea to write an oral history, I wasn't thinking this will present a great opportunity to talk about truth and point of view and memory and all those things. But when I started writing, I realized that you can't write this story without touching on the fact that people remember things differently. Mm. People remember things typically in a very self-serving way. And everything that all of the characters are telling the reader are filtered through their personality, their motivations, their biases. And so that became a very, very important piece of it by necessity. There are areas of the story where people don't agree, or one person will give a detail that seems really specific, it must be true, and then another person will give a detail that's equally specific and completely contradictory. And you know, I think there is a way for me to write this book and say, well, I know the exact truth, and then I'm going to use each character in a certain way to stand on either side of that truth. I didn't do that. I felt like the truth is somewhere in here. Where it is up to each individual person, including me. And so there are certain moments where I may think, well, when Karen and Warren don't agree, I'm siding, you know, more with Karen, or you know. But I think people will read it and feel that way, that there may be a character that you relate to more or makes more sense to you. And so when they give an account of something, you think that's probably the closest one to the truth. That's what I'm going to go with.
Point of view is very important when you're writing. You know, you can have close third person or actual first person. This, you're switching point of view pretty much every other paragraph. So again, what were the challenges there?
You know, I just had to make sure that I knew each character really well. I had to make sure that I knew not just how they felt in the 70s, but how they feel now about what happened in the 70s, which are two different things, and how they're explaining away their behavior to themselves, which we always do when we're looking back. And so it was just really important to make sure that I knew who each person was. And I knew how they felt about each other, even if it's not on the page. At one point, I think I even had like a diagram of the whole band. And I was like, well, how does Warren feel about Eddie? How does Eddie feel about Daisy? How does Daisy feel about, you know, and so that, you know, you have arrows pointing from everyone to everyone at some point, because you should be asking yourself, even if it's not on the page, when these seven people, because it's Daisy Jones and the six, you know, when these seven people are in a room, how do they feel about each other and how does that change? So it was a lot of asking myself those questions before I started writing and as I was writing to make sure that each character felt distinct.
That's so important. And again, something we've talked about before, a character does not exist in isolation. So when you rub them up against someone else and see how they react. Of course, the only person who stays herself all the way through is Daisy. She really doesn't give a crap what people think of her.
Yeah, that is true. She her arc is very much based on her own motivations as opposed to in reaction to things. And actually, I would say Karen, to some extent, that's true too. It's funny. I think the women in this story know themselves better than the men in the story.
Well, that was a great, and that's the thing that I think sets this apart from a lot of rock books and rock biographies, is it's usually, especially if it's you guys in a band, you hear from the guys, you never hear from the girlfriends, you never hear from the ex-wives, you never hear from the groupies, but they all get a voice in this one. That must have been a fun opportunity.
Yeah, it was absolutely fun. It was also, to me, the only way that I could write this story. I think a lot of times we dismiss certain roles in these tropes that we tell, right? Like, we know the story of a rock band. We've told it over and over and over, and we always tell it from the same point of view, and we always tell the same story, more or less. It's like, you know, this genius man, and he, you know, gets fame, and he gets isolated and does a lot of drugs, and suddenly thinks he's a genius and he doesn't listen to anyone else, and then he crashes and starts to realize what he's lost, and, you know, and he makes amends. And I just wasn't interested in doing that. I'm much more interested in what it's like to be his wife and what it's like to see him really try to fix his life. So Camila, Billy's wife, is a big part of this story, and the book has a lot of respect for her, which I think is not always the case when we tell these stories. Daisy Jones starts out as a groupie but insists upon being taken seriously as an artist. And again, you know, I don't think we see that as often. But I'm very interested in telling women's stories and stories of women that will continue to push to be accepted on their own terms or to have exactly the life that they want. Daisy, Karen, the keyboardist, Camila, Billy's wife, and Simone, Daisy's best friend, who's a disco singer, are all very focused on what they want to get out of the world.
Obviously, there are echoes of bands like Fleetwood Mac, the Eagles, those kind of California West Coast bands. Is there a danger? I mean, I love hearing rock and roll stories. And of course, real life is always stranger than fiction. Mm-hmm. What's extraordinary about this is you've made a fiction that's probably more extraordinary than real life. But did that give you pause? Did you think, I mean, you've done it with Hollywood already, but did you think, I'm kind of up against real life here? That's a big challenge, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've said before, you know, Fleetwood Mac was a huge inspiration for this story, and a big reason why I set it in the 70s. But I knew from the beginning that I couldn't write a woman that was supposed to be Stevie Nicks, mm-hmm. because there can be no Stevie Nicks but Stevie Nicks. And anytime you're going to try to emulate her, you're going to fall short, yeah. right? When you talk about truth is stranger than fiction, like, it's the glamour of Stevie cannot be contained in a book. So I would have failed if that's what I was trying to do. So I set out very purposefully to say, you know, these are the stories that we know the most about this time. These are the women and these are the men that we think of when we think about this time. So I want to come up with a man and a woman who can lead this band, who can live amongst them, but are not them, because otherwise I'm just gonna fail. So it's like, you know, Billy Dunn cannot be Mick Jagger. There's only one Jagger. And so Billy's a completely different person. If anything, I might have stolen a little bit from Springsteen for Billy. That I think is the one place where I just couldn't help myself, because my love of Bruce Springsteen is so deep. But yeah, And the other thing too is you have to be mindful of telling a story that's true versus telling a story that feels like it's true. And the most important thing I think is to tell a story, and when you're writing fiction, that feels true. So when you look at the things that like Led Zeppelin was doing in the 70s, mm-hmm. it's like, I'm not going to write a book about that. No one would believe it. No one would believe it. You know, it's like, and a lot of the stuff gets, you know, you read about like Keith Richards in the 70s and it's like, that's not I don't want to go there. You know, it's too much. So it was finding that balance of how do I write a band and led by these two people that essentially become icons that can hold their own and tell a story that is both larger than life and honest. Mm-hmm. And so that took some fine tuning for sure. Yeah.
What I really enjoy in this book is you've got this creative tug of war between Daisy and Billy. You've got two people who are used to getting their own way, two captains, if you like, mm-hmm. having to compromise and work together. And that insight to the creative process is absolutely brilliant. I'm going to ask you a question here, because I know you've written for TV, and of course writing in TV and film is very collaborative, mm-hmm. but one of the joys of writing a novel is it's just you yeah. writing the novel. The mm-hmm. editor comes in eventually. Mm-hmm. So could you, mm-hmm. having got used to being a novelist mm-hmm. and having it all your own way, mm-hmm. could you co-write a novel with someone?
No, absolutely not. No. You know, it's funny. I think part of the reason why I like to write novels more than I like to write film and TV is that reason. It's one vision, and I like that. I have worked collaboratively in TV and film, and I am not my best self. I do. There are moments where I hear myself thinking, like, whatever this person's saying is not as good as the idea that I just had, you know, and then I hear it and I'm like, oh, okay, maybe it is. Maybe it is. You know, I get very tunnel vision and I see something very clearly and I know exactly how I want to do it. And it's very hard for me to break out of that. And I've learned to do it to the betterment of any project that I've worked on, because I'm, you know, tunnel vision and feeling like, you know, you can see it clearly are great in certain aspects. But when it comes to film and television, you have to listen to other people and you have to understand that your way is not always the best way or even often the best way. My husband and I work together a lot and we adapt things, and he's a screenwriter and he's been very patient with me as I start to understand that passion and a strong point of view are very good things, right? But as the book attests to, one person believing that they know the best way and not being able to listen to other people will eventually lead to failure. You have to grow and you have to hear other people and be exposed to new ideas. So it's like a thing that it doesn't come natural to me. I have to go above my impulses and learn. And so, you know, TV and film is really fun. I think it is a bit more fun than writing a book, but I feel more comfortable in the space of writing a book because taking notes and listening to other people's ideas is much more passive. I write it, someone else reads it, they give me ideas, and I sit there and I go, this one, yes, this one, yes, this one, maybe yes. not. You know, it's a bit more easier for me.
Pick and choose.
When it's all in a group setting and everyone's throwing things, I can't recognize it as well. I'm too set in my own ways.
Yeah. I've done both and I totally understand. I mean, would it be too much to say that with Billy and Daisy, you're exploring a kind of ego id thing going on there? Is that yourself?
Oh, for sure. I mean, a little bit. Like, there are definitely parts of Billy that are written where he's saying things that I try not to think, if that makes sense. You know, it's like my worst self is there are definitely moments of the things that Billy's saying, or maybe the way that Billy's behaving that he doesn't see that he's doing, that those are things I try to rise above, but Billy doesn't. Billy thinks that he's totally right to have done them. And Daisy too, look, like, you know, Daisy is very confident in everything that she does, but she's coming up against the issue of people not taking her seriously and wanting to be heard for what she has to say. And there's a part of me that I can filter through her a little bit there too. They're both writers, and you know, they write songs as opposed to novels, but it's that same impulse. And so I definitely think there's the tug of war between Daisy and Billy is not in any direct way, the tug of war between my haves, but it's certainly representative of the ways in which the creative process is a lot of contradictory things at once.
Excellent stuff. I want to talk about the world building for a second, because you've written the lyrics to their classic album, Aurora, yeah. Which, listeners, doesn't exist, but there is a Spotify playlist, and we'll put a link in the show notes so that you can get an idea of what kind of album it is. But you've written all of the lyrics to this, plus lyrics to all of their early, yeah. You get snippets of them all the way through. Mm-hmm. Where did that come in the process? Was that something you built beforehand or as you were writing?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I felt like the lyrics had to be in the book. Because if I was reading the book, I would want them. But I did not want to write them. And so, because I'm not a songwriter and I don't see myself that way, and it wasn't something I had any experience in. So I started off thinking, if I'm going to write a book about a fictitious album, then I should know what that album is, and then I can write a book about it. So I sat down and I wrote some songs that were thematically about things that I knew thematically the book would be about. Indulgence and temptation and addiction and things like that. And they were awful. I mean, they were truly awful. I hadn't written any of the book. They were just really generic. There was nothing that caught you about any of them. And I was like, I'm doomed. This is not going to go well. So I put it to the side and I decided to write the first draft. And so I wrote the first draft and I'd come upon a moment in which I needed to reference a song. And whatever came to me at that moment, it's like, for instance, Billy writes a song. One of the first songs that you hear about in the stories is this song that Billy writes for his then girlfriend, I guess, Camila, who becomes his wife, called Senora. And he writes it is what he thinks is like this really romantic song for her. And I wanted, it is a romantic song, but they're not married, so technically Camila would be a senorita. But there's that white man thing of like, I can go so far, but I can't think too far ahead, because he doesn't actually understand Spanish, So I would say, oh, okay, I'm going to call this Senora, and that's going to, and then I'd have to reference a lyric and I'd be like, all right, well, let me just, in this moment, what do I think Billy would say? And I'd write like a little bit and then I keep going. And by the end of I got to the end of the book and I had, maybe like five songs that had been referenced in the book and then the entire album that's referenced very heavily in the book. Mm. And I thought, all right, now I got to go write all these songs. But it was actually much easier once I had written the book, because I realized what I was missing before was specificity. I was missing point of view. I didn't know who Billy was. I didn't know who Daisy was. I didn't know the context, the perfectly, exquisitely specific context that eventually became the writing of Aurora. I didn't have any of that. So now it was like, okay, well, I need a song that Daisy would have written that is a very like plaintive, clear as day to anyone that's looking at it, song about this, but that someone else could say, oh no, I actually think it's about this. I had very specific rules that I needed to follow. And these voices that I had been working with for a whole draft to use to do it. So it became much, much easier. I suddenly felt like, oh, I get this. And I know how Daisy would talk. And I know how Billy would talk. And I know the types of metaphors they'd be drawn to. And it became a lot more fun.
There's more of our interview with Taylor over on Patreon, and here is a little teaser. Someone's going to have to write those songs.
I know. It's great. So at the back of the book, all of the songs to Aurora are in there, and they will take, the album Aurora and a lot of the other songs that are peppered throughout and create a sound for this band and create the album.
Is there any dream artist you'd like to come in and record for you?
It's funny. There have been so many artists that have been mentioned that now that people talk about them, I think, oh yeah, we do have a couple of artists who are a flashback to the 70s in some ways.
I was talking to one of the authors we've recorded on here before, Joanna Nadin, who met you the other day, and she said, I have to ask you about the Jennifer Aniston story. You say you went from college straight to Hollywood. Was there a Hollywood dream? Did you want to write movies? Is that where you started out?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know that I wanted to write, but I always wanted to move to Hollywood. I'm from the East Coast of the States, I think I was 10 years old and saying, like, I'm going to Hollywood. Like, I knew it was just something that I wanted to do. I wanted to live in Los Angeles. That was the beginning and the end of it. That's what I was going to do.
What was the kind of most important thing you drew from that? Because there's so much there.
Well, like she said, it was trying to write a book with one hand tied behind her back by denying herself a lot of the usual tools that we use as writers, which is that prose stuff, which is descriptions, which is getting inside the minds of the characters. Sooner or later, you need to make a decision about what road you're going to go down. And that's where the crippling anxiety comes in, because you start thinking, oh, what if it's the wrong road? What if it's a dead end? And this is where you need to learn to love the rewrites, really.
So, Mark, what's been happening on social media this week?
We've had a lovely week on social media. Now, you know, we were talking about the genre of our book and how it's a bit of a, I call it a mongrel. It's you know, it's a bit all over the place.
Mongrel.
Well, we had a lovely tweet from Teresa Rice, who is at Rice for Brains, which is the best
Love it. Name of the week.
Yeah, she said, I would call Back to Reality magical realism as far as genre goes, and that's one I've not dabbled with, actually. Now, magical realism isn't an option on BookBub, which is why I'm doing a lot of the ads at the moment. But it's something I'm going to investigate and give it a try. So thanks for that, Teresa. We'll let you know how that turns out. Be interested to see if that actually works. GM White, who is at GM White, writes, now you've hinted at this a couple of times on the show, Mr. D. He sent me a link to the movie Yesterday, which stars your mate, Ed Sheeran, in a small role.
Yes.
About a guy who wakes up in a world where only he remembers the Beatles. So he starts playing Beatles songs and he's a megastar overnight. So, of course, it's about someone whose life is in a rut. They some weird magical realism event happens. They play music and they, you know, it changes their life. And he said, hey, Bestseller XP, this film looks like it might be a bit of a hit, and I detect some crossover of theme with Back to Reality. Yeah, no kidding. Any plans... any plans to harness that in your marketing? So, yeah, we need to get our thinking caps on.
It's a brilliant question.
Yeah.
If you like Yesterday, you'll love Back to Reality, right? Yeah. Because, I mean, Yesterday comes out in the cinema in June, I believe, in both the UK. They've tied it in with Glastonbury. There's a reason for them doing that. It's written by Richard Curtis, who is... Yeah. You know, the guy behind Four Weddings and Funeral.
Yeah, yeah. And Blackadder.
Well, I mean, every film that Hugh Grant was ever in. And then it was also directed by none other than Mr. Trainspotting, I believe.
Danny Boyle, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah,
Danny Boyle. Yeah. So it's quite and Ed Sheeran makes an appearance in it. I don't know how much Ed is actually in it. I don't know whether he's just there to help with the trailers, because obviously, but there's a very funny bit in the trailer, actually, if you haven't seen it, about where he's written, Hey Jude. And Ed Sheeran's like, no, dude, it has to be dude. Hey, dude, right? So it's good. But there is a lot of crossover, actually. So it'd be very interesting to see how well that movie does. Mm. It's got that British feel to it as well.
It's going to be a smash hit. It's going to be a smash hit. You just look at it. It's got hit written all over it. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, but that's a great question. We should have a discussion around that. Like, what do you do when there's a novel, or maybe there's another big book that's come out, which is being successful? I mean, in this case, it's a book rather than it's a film rather than a book. So you can't really say, well, how did they market the book? Because there's not a book. There's probably a book attached to it, but it's all about the film. But maybe there's some crossover things about how they're actually promoting it. Mm. I mean, it helps to have Ed Sheeran in the film. I think that's a huge thing. I mean, it's not really something we can replicate. But there's a lot of weird things going on, like, because we talked about Ed, didn't we, at one point? We also talked about Lady Gaga, and then she went on to win an Oscar. I'm not going to say what we talked about, because I want to keep that quiet for now, but we will reveal that eventually in the podcast. But there's a lot of weird stars aligning in our world right now with this book, which makes me think that something's going to happen.
Yeah,
I can feel it in my waters. but if you go to see the film, let us know what you think and tell us where you think the similarities are. Here's a good question. Where are the similarities between the film Yesterday and the film Back to Reality that was written a few years before the film?
We had a lovely tweet from Mark Edwards, best-selling author. Mark Edwards, former guest on the show. We love Mark. He's absolutely he's the author of The Retreat and Follow You Home. In fact, by the time this podcast goes out, his new book, Last of the Magpies, will be out. So congratulations with that, Mark. Hope it's a smash hit.
Well done, Mark.
He said, cleaning out the shed while listening to a fascinating interview with Dave Grockeran on the bestseller experiment about how Amazon's algorithms work. Highly recommended to my fellow authors. The podcast, not shed cleaning, unless you write in your shed. So thank you very much for that, Mark. This made me, one, I love that Mark still listens to the show. That's just amazing. That's
absolutely.
But I have a bone to pick with you, Mark Edwards. Now, if you go on Amazon UK and you type in the name Mark Stay, not that I do that on a daily basis.
No, of course you don't.
But if you type in Mark Stay, I'm the first thing that comes up. Right. It used to be a brand of brass rubber or something, but now it's me. First thing is End of Magic, Back to Reality. But in third place, it's not Robot Overlords. Oh, no. It's Mark's Edwards book that's coming in September called Here to Stay. So that combination of Mark Edwards, Here to Stay, Mark Stay. So come
that's
September.
Genius, Mark.
No, it's not.
No, because it is. It's clever. It's brilliant. It's Mr. Edwards has obviously looked at your rising star and he's thought, I need to jump on the back of this. Mr. Stays. What if I called my book? What if I put the word stay in it? Yeah. Maybe I'll mess up the algorithms and get in. I think it's genius, Mr. Edwards. I think I bow to your incredibleness.
Never mind that. That means whenever I type my name in on Amazon, his book is going to come top. That's not fair, Mr. Edwards. Change the title.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. Does
Here
it not
to
work
devote,
both ways?
Call it that.
No, but doesn't it not work both ways? When people type in Mark Edwards, they might get a book written by Mark Stay in the list. Have you checked that?
Well, I don't know. I'll check that in a minute. Yeah,
interesting. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what, though? This takes on a whole new level. Because we did this within music. We actually renamed one of our remixes. I'll say this, I can admit this now because it's many years on. We renamed one of our remixes and we put the word zero and then something blah, 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 and then seven in the name of the remix because we were always being compared to the band 07. And we thought if we put the words zero and seven in the remix name, if someone searches for 07, they might find us. And because we knew we were like them, they might like our music. So there are lots of things. I mean, we talk about like throwaway titles and stuff, but there are ways that you can use a title, as Mr. Edwards has demonstrated, to infiltrate other popular authors such as Mr. Stay.
He's great. They've been cheap.
Of course, Mark will deny all this on Twitter now, hopefully. Mr. Edwards will come out and say that, no, I didn't do that at all. Which would be great.
Sorry, I've just noticed, just clicking on the End of Magic on Amazon, I've got a new review. Ooh, five stars. That's come out today. Pace and punch grabs the reader. This book, sorry, I'm just... pimping myself here. This book grabbed me in the first couple of pages, and when two or three of the brief chapters I was in this world with its magic, yet eerie familiar feel, geography, look at the maps and multiple metaphors and allegories for our own world of disasters. Still, the cracking pace, story and characters keeps you whizzing through, only thinking of the human parallels at the end. I read it in two sittings on successive days. Couldn't stop. Really, what more? Hope there will be another at least smiley face. Woohoo! That's from Sheila M. Thank you, Sheila M. You've just made my day. Hey!
Dear listener, you can't see Mark's face right now, but as we talked about earlier, signing a book is one thing. That's living the dream. But reading a review like that of a book that you've spent many, many months, sometimes years writing, doesn't that make it all worthwhile?
Oh, mate, I've had a bit of a drought. I haven't had a new review for about a month either, so that's really made my day. That's just fantastic.
Brilliant. Firstly, if you leave reviews, that's how happy you make an author.
Oh, yeah,
but
man.
Secondly, if you haven't published your book yet, here's the incentive to get it done. Get it done so that you can read people write reviews like that, because it is the best feeling in the world. Well done, Mark. It's a lovely feeling, isn't it? It makes it, and they keep coming, it's just one of those things that just keeps topping you up as a writer. I think when people haven't released anything, they don't get that wonderful feedback, and it's hard to sometimes keep on going. So push, get that book out, start getting your reviews, and realise that there are people out there that are going to love what you do.
Yeah.
Fantastic stuff.
And just to end on a sad note, and I need to thank Zach Urlocker, one of our listeners, for drawing this to my attention. He tagged us on Twitter with this. Sad to report that one of our guests, the great Warren Adler, author of The War of the Roses and many, many more, sadly passed away in the last week or so. And it was such a privilege to interview him recently. And he was such a gent, a truly inspirational writer. And what got me. He was 91 when he passed. He was still fizzing with ideas and innovation. He was working on an audiobook autobiography of his life. He still had ideas for stories. He had so much energy. I only hope that when I'm 91, I have half the energy that he had, the passion for writing that he had. So, Warren Adler, rest in peace, sir. It was a real pleasure to speak to you.
Brilliant stuff. It's incredible to have that. And if you missed that, do go and check the show notes. You'll be able to listen back to that interview, which, you know, has a lot more meaning now because it was so recently that you talked to him.
Yeah.
So thank you so much to everyone for joining us today. Thank you indeed for all of your support, your ongoing support. Do pop along to our Facebook page. If you are signing up to Patreon, do send us those photos. I'm serious. I want to see them. Tell us about your books. When you sign up to Patreon, we like to obviously give your book a plug as well, or whichever book you're thinking of writing. To do that, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/support and you can sign up there. You'll get access as well to well over, approaching, I think, 50 hours of deep dive material as well, which is kind of like university level, conference level, incredible expert advice where we deep dive on very specific topics. And those are worth their weight in gold. That's not me saying that. That's the people that have supported this podcast saying that. That's what we constantly hear on the BXP team. So, Mark, is there anything else we should talk about, the other places people can come find us?
Come and see us on Facebook. We're on Bestseller Experiment at Facebook. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Bestseller XP. We're on Pinterest too. If you've got artwork you want to show off, we've got a board there for all our listeners. So come and drop us a line there too. Subscribe, rate and review on your podcatcher of choice. It really makes a difference. It makes us a lot more visible and helps people make their mind up if they want to listen to the show. And big thanks, as always, to Dave, our editor, who performs miracles on a weekly basis. Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dave. So it's a goodbye from Mark 1.
And a goodbye from Mark 2. Goodbye!
Goodbye!